show. You're listening to CJFF 90.1 FM at Simon Fraser University.
Hello, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Mihai Kovasar. I'm here again with my guest hosts, Brandon Brownlee and Tegan Marshall. And today, we're going to do the second part in this series of indeterminate length on the philosophy of law. So I'm going to start by doing a little recap of what we talked about last time, and from there move into the last of the cases that I had to present, and hopefully get your thoughts on how these cases went, what you think in terms of the rulings, and yeah, where this goes as far as our perspective on law. Last time I introduced the two sort of primary camps in this debate around the nature of law. I talked about the legal positivists and the natural law theorists. The natural law theorists are those like Thomas Aquinas, St. Thomas Aquinas, and John Finnis in the more modern day, who basically, their view is that law is something that is not distinct from morality. It is a form of morality that we can discover by using our faculty of reason to engage with the divine to some extent. First, Thomas Aquinas, it's revealed theology that tells us what our laws will be then, our man-made laws. And for Finnis, he doesn't take quite so strictly theological a view, but essentially he talks about natural law and how that there's a right form of law that comes from this use of reason applied to divine commandments or to goods, public goods of some kind. And that a law that is not a real law in that sense is no law at all, and therefore we have no obligation to obey it. The legal positivists, on the other hand, are the camp that fight against that. I talked about the authors John Austin and H.L.A. Hart, who basically their view is that no, law and morality are actually distinct. They are separable, and I'm going to get into this shortly, but Hart calls that the separability thesis. So that is essentially the view that law and morality are not one and the same. Laws can advance justice and goods in society, but there's no essential connection there. And their view is descriptive of how we behave, where law comes from, and what authority is. They, of course, have different accounts of authority, for example. The natural law theorists might say that, so for Aquinas, I'll repeat the quote. It goes something like, law is an ordinance of reason for the common good made by him who has care of the community and promulgated. So it's an order. It's reasonable or found through reason. It promotes a certain common good. It is made by someone who has care of the community. It doesn't specify who. Of course, we can have some rebuttals there. And, of course, made known, promulgated. On the other hand, for the legal positivists, it matters a bit more. And Hart has a view of these rules. I believe I mentioned the primary and secondary rules. But in case I didn't touch on it enough, I'll just say primary rules are your laws, substantive laws. Don't murder, don't steal, don't whatever. And your secondary laws underlie those. And you have something like the rule of recognition, he calls it, which is a secondary rule that basically says laws are only valid when the population gives their recognition or their acknowledgement of that, of the validity of that law. So they recognize the ruler and they agree that, you know, that ruler is going to give them their laws, and then they recognize the laws, and that's what makes them valid. So different accounts on all of these things. I also briefly mentioned sort of four characteristics that you might think about when we're talking about law and what law is. I mentioned authority. So like I said, where does the law come from? Practicality. So is it enforceable, and is it enforced, and is it clear, and is it prospective rather than retrospective, for example. You can't, a lot of people say that it's not right to reach into the past and say, oh, the law in passing now applies to people that in the past to whom that law didn't exist previously. So, for example, if you stole yesterday, but I only made stealing a law today, I still punish you for stealing. That's what we call a retroactive law. A lot of people see issue with that. So that's about practicality. Universality, so of course, does it apply to everyone, including the lawmakers, to an equal extent? And lastly, justice or fairness. And that's, again, that's a question of the where the positivists and the natural law theorists disagree is primarily on that point. Is there anything about law that needs to be just or fair? Well, let me talk about Dworkin, and then we'll get into the cases afterwards. Dworkin was a student of Hart's. He, as any good student does, disagreed with him on something, took a lot of his ideas, but also disagreed on some things. He said, yeah, a lot of what Hart is saying about legal positivism seems to be pretty true, pretty accurate in its description of how we function under law, but something, there's still something normative about the nature of law that Hart is missing. So according to Dworkin, he refutes Hart on two points. The first is the separability thesis that I talked about. So he actually rejects the idea that law and morality are separate. He thinks there are some, what he calls, principles underlying the legal system that are normative in nature and that are inseparable from the way we do law. So you might think of things like no one can be a judge in his own case. Or a judge must hear from all sides in a fair trial. These are these principles that underlie the legal system that we can't really slot in as, they're not substantive laws. There's nowhere written down that a judge has to hear both sides in a statute or something. But they still seem to underlie the system. You might also think of rights here, the question of rights, where let's say in a constitutional democracy like we have in Canada, right, we have entrenched rights that are written as law, but in other systems, or perhaps even with the rights that we do have entrenched, there's a question of, like, how do you slot those into, are they primary rules? Are they kind of more fundamental than the other substantive laws that sit on top of them? We would usually say yes. So, yeah. So that's the first problem, is that they're not actually, so Dworkin says they're not actually separate, as separate as we would think. And the second point is the what he calls the social fact thesis. So Hart advances this view that basically legal validity, the validity of laws, is just observed from social facts. Like we behave as if we are bound by these laws. Of course, there's no moral obligation to obey them because they're not morals, but we obey them because they're backed by sanctions and that kind of thing. And yeah, these social facts, this kind of very descriptive third-person view of a society behaving under law is how we should look at laws. And Dworkin says, principles aren't social facts, though. You can't describe them in the same way. And again, they seem to be more fundamental to the system than Hart is giving them credit for. So that's the two main points on which he refutes Hart. And so really, at the end of the day, he's a natural law theorist. I mean, fundamentally, if you agree that law and morality are linked, you're a natural law theorist, not a legal positivist. But he likes a lot of what Hart says about the way the legal system is constructed and that kind of thing.
It's interesting.
Yeah, go ahead, Brandon.
It's interesting that Dworkin criticizes Hart on this idea that, or on the social fact thesis, because Hart does have this distinction between external and internal perspectives in relation to law, right? So Hart does have a place in his positivist theory for descriptions of law from a first person perspective where normativity is experienced. I don't think that he does also have the external perspective, and that's where he tries to account for the descriptive facts, the way that the positivist actually describes the laws. But Dworkin does kind of, is he really remedying or is he really replacing anything when he talks about this distinction between rules and principles? The principles seem to be internally, like they're internally experienced. That's true. Whether Dworkin's is supplying something that Hart doesn't have, I don't know. But I do think that the other features of principles and the relation that principles have to rules in Dworkin's theory is illuminating. This idea that with Dworkin, there are... So Dworkin tells us that Hart discussed rules. He discussed them externally, internally, and that's interesting, but he failed to talk about principles, which are distinct from rules. Rules are kind of an all-or-nothing thing. You either break a rule or you abide by a rule. But when we're doing this legal interpretation, that's not, we're not just checking to see whether they broke a rule or not. We're actually weighing certain things, and that's the principles that Dworkin's is talking about.
Yeah, it's just as we're talking about, you know, whether it's a rule or whether it's a more internal conviction, this is very similar to something that that W.D. Ross talks about when he talks about his applied ethical theories, particularly his prima facie duties that focus on fidelity, gratitude, non-maleficence, beneficence, all these different things. Because the way Ross argued that one should determine how to apply an ethical standard was to see what commitments, what duties they had in relation to another person. So if you save my life and I am just a grumpy old man about it, that's an ethical problem for us, because you have a duty to gratitude. And so in me not doing that, I'm breaking that ethical standard that shapes his morality. So it's just very similar that we're having this discussion about what is codified and what is more internal, that this is a common theme for people in the legal space.
Absolutely, yeah. Speaking of which, what I'll say before I get to sort of Dworkin's or a reply to Dworkin, that idea of obligation, I think I did bring it up last time, but it's good to touch back on. It's, you know, why are we obliged to obey the laws in the first place, right? A lot of us, excuse me, a lot of us say that we obey laws because, you know, we're afraid of getting punished for it. Sometimes people don't obey laws when they know they're not going to be punished. So there's very much this, like, instrumental or very sanction-based view of it, which seems to sit with the positivists. But in other senses, when you see something unjust, especially in the legal space, in a court or something, you're like, hey, you know, maybe this isn't written down, but there's something wrong here, right? And you're right, the way to look at laws either as from a sense of conviction and duty or just obliged by sanctions, it's sort of a contrasting view. So someone like Austin that came before Hart would say, yeah, all it is sanctions. Like, you're going to get punished if you don't obey, and so you obey the laws, right? Hart says, okay, well, you know, maybe it's not that simple. Maybe, and this is where the rule of recognition comes in. He says, okay, we obey these laws because we've agreed to obey to them. That's why the gunman in the park that I talked about last time, someone that stands on the park road and points a gun at you and says, you know, give me everything you've got. And you say, well, you don't have the right to do that. And he says, well, if it makes it any easier for you, I'm the government in this park, and this is my tax. So that's all that's happening here. You say, no, you're not. And Hart says, okay, that's because there is no recognition of authority and of the validity of the laws there. On the other hand, the positivist or the natural law theorist has a very simple answer to why we obey. It's because it's the right thing to do. And to your point, Brandon, what Dworkin says is judges are there to judge. I mean, it's in the name. So it's not just that they're glorified readers of whatever someone, the legislature wrote down in black letters, but they actually apply some discretion, right? How could you do that if it was just a matter of written law and not, and nothing normative? Tegan, I want to let you speak before I get to the rebuttal to that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the whole, sorry, the whole adjudication process of legal and ethical decisions is probably what people care the most about at the end of the day, is how do we come to that place? And that's obviously a large part of the course that I'm undertaking right now. Applied ethics in the criminal justice system is to say, okay, it's good to talk about utilitarianism and Kantianism and rights theory and all of that, but how is that applied? And so that's where Ross becomes the most compelling, because Ross kind of stands firmly in that gap of that kind of, well, how do we actually adjudicate this? Because we're the utilitarians would say, well, we argue and we make a judgment for the best results. Okay, well, how do you define the best results? Because even if there is a larger number benefit to a decision, that may not be right. If an example of this would be, if there was a riot going on in town and there was a man this riot was about, and so he was then put in jail under false pretenses, the utilitarian would say, or the I can't speak today apparently, would say, well, you know, yeah, that's not good, but at least the riots have died down and we've gone back to normal. And we say, well, it's a problem. So then you switch to a more Kantian perspective, which is very much the law is the law, period. That to do anything else would be wrong. So then Roth says, I don't know if I jive with either of those, really, because what it comes down to is what our duties are. So his major emphasis is on the like seven duties that he lists, but is to say, because many people wanted him to rank these duties and say, tell us which is the most important. And he said, well, I can't and I won't do that, because we need to approach every ethical case as its own, as it is. And so I think it kind of brings us back to that question of adjudication, and then whether we could even make a set of laws in the first place. So I'll let you continue from there, see if you have any response to any of that.
No, I think that's really interesting. I think what that does, man, I'm in a couple of courses now, constitutional law, federalism and the Canadian Constitution, philosophy of law, and the judicial role has been so fascinating to me to study over the past little while, because it's easy to mythologize judges one way or another, to strawman them and say they only apply their own personal beliefs and opinions, or they read the law too firmly and they are giving us bad results that way. They're not democratically elected, so that might be a problem, but also they seem to be experts and we want experts judging our laws. So like all of these things really play together. What I'm hearing on Ross's view there is that like it's very much akin to what Finnis says, in that Finnis enumerates seven goods, you know, amongst which are life, aesthetic experience, practical reasonableness, you know, some. So he has a list of seven, and he says law cannot sacrifice any one of those goods in favor of another, and law has the duty to promote at least one of those goods. And so that's how you discovered good real laws, is that they promote a certain combination of those goods and don't sacrifice any of them. So again, he doesn't rank them, but except maybe practical reasonableness, which allows us to find laws in the first place, has a sort of special role. But otherwise, he doesn't rank them either. He says, okay, this is where the this is what the goods are that we're looking for. Law has got to do that. But here's the my reply, or here's Hart's reply, and my take on it is that Hart is going to ask Dworkin, well, are those really moral principles, or are they, in a sense, epistemic principles that judges are founding their discretion on? Like, is it really a moral principle that someone should, and this is me talking now as an example, is it really a moral principle that a judge has to hear both sides to a case, or is it simply a matter of the judge can't reasonably read the law and apply it to the situation if they don't have all the information from both sides that would be necessary to do so, right? And you may answer and say, okay, well, if one side can give all the information, would that still be a fair trial? I don't know if I know what to say to that, but I think it's a compelling reply to say, well, yeah, are those really moral principles? Do they advance a good in some way, or are they just epistemic or principles that judges apply in their discretion? Brandon, I see you might have something to say.
Yeah,
go ahead.
That's a good, I think that's a really good question. I mean, we're kind of untangling and making a distinction here. There really is this question of, okay, this kind of, it tickles our sense of justice when things that seem unjust happen. Is it more or less an epistemic thing, you're saying? You know, when we have fair trials, we need all the information, and that's an epistemic requirement. We can't say that we have put our minds to it if we haven't put our minds to the whole mast. There's almost like a psychologism explanation to it. We experience our epistemic normativity as justice, which in a certain, I mean, we have to remember, epistemology is an axiology. Epistemology is a normative field, and they do kind of have a relation to each other. When you know things for reasons. There are conditions for satisfying that, and knowing things puts you in certain conditions for doing things and whatnot. So they do have a kind of relation. The interesting thing that I'm seeing, maybe this is another angle we can take at it, is this is, this is a question that can be asked of all natural law theories in general, where, okay, you have normativity, you have some kind of ground that your laws stand on and take their condition from, but there really is this question of, well, why justice? Why is normativity rooted in this particular, you know, we might say virtue or experience or feeling? Why fairness? Why shouldn't our normativity be something like epistemology? Could it be that way? Do we really experience it? So I don't have answers to these, but I'm just noticing that that's a very interesting disentanglement to go through.
These questions of where we come to understand these kind of basic, almost inherent kind of legal ideas, right? Of wealth. Let's take the principle of fidelity, for example, that Ross highlights in the prima facie duties. The reason the prima facie duties are created, as I said earlier, are in part to demonstrate not just abstract ethical application, but actually, I think, in my reading and in my time, to demonstrate how we apply ethics in relationships. So to see that fidelity is the first and foremost kind of foundational principle of which any kind of relationship, whether that be personal, professional, or legal, is based upon. Right? Ross makes a major emphasis on how even in personal conversation, someone who wants to be moral and ethically upright must tell the truth in conversation. Because if you don't start there, there's no basis of which for you to build that relationship from. And so that idea of fidelity, to the natural law theorist's point, raises the question of, well, where does that desire for that fidelity come from? And so I think to have that kind of almost phenomenological view of law, to say that, as Mihai pointed out earlier, I think, Mihai, you raised the question of, do we as society give law its value, or does law itself have inherent value? I know that's not where we're taking it, and I'll let you get back to it, but I still think that's a valuable question to really parse out, because if the law is valuable on its own, then we almost shouldn't care about fidelity, because in a lot of ways, fidelity is an emotional reaction.
On the point of obligation, St. Thomas Aquinas would say, on his view, you obviously shouldn't disobey a real law, and any law that's not a real law, and therefore isn't a law at all, doesn't need to be obeyed. So if it doesn't further the common good in some way, you know, and if it doesn't come from the authority of the community, you don't need to obey it. Finnis says, well, yes, sort of, but you may want to obey laws just for the purpose of, let's say, social cohesion. Like, you want to keep a certain degree of order. And so here's where what you are bringing up, Tegan, I'm not convinced that the link has been made between these principles of, let's say, fidelity or the sense of justice we feel and the law itself. Upholding goods and being moral is a question, and an important question, or an aim. And obeying the laws and making good laws is also an aim. I'm not convinced that they're the same aim. And so in that sense, that's why the positivist account seems compelling to me, is because, well, we can still do what the normative law, what the natural law theorist is asking us to do, which is to act morally, to pursue certain goods. But is law essentially the same in its origin or its essence as our normative and moral aims? And I'm not convinced that they are, because the law may be a tool toward that. And again, laws certainly do advance goods and justice and fairness in a lot of cases, but sometimes they just authorize the creation of a school board, tell you to drive on the right side of the road. Like, that doesn't seem clearly related to our normative aims or to any foundational goods. And so, in a sense, just the existence of some examples of laws that aren't strictly moral is evidence against the fact that all laws are essentially tied to morality, right?
Well, I mean, that's if you're just going to take the law at face value and not try to extrapolate some, like, the whole idea of driving on the right side of the road. Someone could link that to morality, to say we don't want to kill anybody by someone driving on the wrong side of the road into oncoming traffic could lead to the possibility of death for people. Therefore, it is a moral action to drive on the right side of the road. But I absolutely agree. And you, Mihai, doing that class on federalism and the Canadian Constitution may have also come across this debate, although it's more alive in American circles, but I think it's still a valuable debate to say, do we take a more originalist position to reading constitutional documents and say, this is what the Constitution says, therefore we apply it in the way that it is written, which would have been, for those of us who are up to date on U.S. politics, would have been someone like Justice Antonin Scalia's position or current Justice Clarence Thomas's position, whereas Justice Breyer, who retired some time ago, was more a fan of a living constitutional view, to say, well, our times are changing in the country, so we better look at the Constitution, absolutely, but we have to try and provide some current cultural context. So I think that's also important when we talk about whether laws